Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama lays out his fiscal 2014 budget plan later today. It includes cuts to the growth of spending on Social Security and limits on tax deductions for the rich. Joining me to talk about his budget and areas of possible compromise with congressional Republicans, Nancy Cook of National Journal Magazine, Kevin Hassett of the American Enterprise Institute, Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Robert Greenstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Do join us with your questions and comments. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to see you all. Nancy Cookie, if I could start with you. We have already heard some of the broad outlines. Give us some of the specifics.
Sure. So the biggest news out of the president's budget that he's going to release at around 11:15 today is really the cuts to Social Security that he's proposing. So that would be about $230 billion in cuts to government benefits, including Social Security. And this is something that the Republicans have long sought. It's not necessarily a new idea for the administration because they had talked about it during the fiscal cliff deal, but the president's really formalizing the offer by putting it in the budget. There are some other sort of top line numbers. There's about $400 billion in cuts to Medicare. And then there's about $580 billion in new revenue that would come through limiting some tax breaks for the rich.
Tell me about those Medicare cuts. Aren't they reduced payments to providers?
Exactly. So they're reduced payments to providers and also to hospitals. And so this is a key tenet of the Democrat strategy so far in proposing any cuts to entitlements. They're really not cutting benefits themselves. They're still trying to make those cuts to the people that provide the care rather than the people who are receiving it.
And what about limits to IRAs?
That's another thing that the president wants to do, and that really goes along with this theme that the president did during the 2012 presidential campaign, which is this idea of making the wealthy pay more. And this would limit IRA accounts, and that's a key thing because Mitt Romney, during the presidential campaign, it was revealed in his tax return that he had this huge amount of money stashed in an IRA account, and this would be one way to limit that.
Nancy Cook of National Journal, how much of what has already been laid out has he proposed before, and how much is new?
I would say much of it has been proposed before. The Medicare cuts have been proposed before. The Social Security cuts have been proposed before, but not in a budget. There are a few new things, like he wants to pay for a new universal pre-kindergarten that would be paid for through increased taxes on tobacco. That's a new idea. He's going to pull in some State of the Union ideas like raising the minimum wage. That would not be paid for by the federal government. That would, of course, have to be paid for by the private sector. So those are some new ideas at the margins. But overall, it's a lot of what we have seen before. The key thing is really a political point that he's trying to make a point to the Republicans that he is willing to make some cuts to Social Security, is willing to make some cuts to Medicare, and that he's serious. He's trying to portray himself as serious on creating a budget deal.
Bob Greenstein, how much did the president get just right?
Well, I think it's important to understand, as the president keeps saying, that this isn't really his preferred budget. This budget has two pieces. We've never seen a budget constructed like this before. The core piece is his final offer to Speaker Boehner and the budget negotiations in December. Compared to his opening offer to Speaker Boehner, which reflects Obama's preferred position, it had $400 billion less in revenue increases, $200 billion more in cuts in non-entitlement programs, somewhat larger Medicare cuts, and the proposal Nancy mentioned regarding adjustments and how the cost of living, the inflation adjustment, is done, both in the tax code and in Social Security. None of that was in his original offer to Boehner, and most of those things are not things that Democrats in general are comfortable with. So he's actually doing something unusual. He's saying, I'm going to make my budget my final offer in the negotiations. That part of the budget would reduce deficits by $1.8 trillion over 10 years. Then he has a second part of the budget. And in the second part of the budget, he has a series of initiatives, all of which are paid for. They're deficit neutral. So he proposes more funding for preschool, particularly for low and moderate income children, and he pays for it by raising tobacco taxes. And what the White House is saying is we support all of these deficit neutral initiatives, but we are not making them a condition of the core offer we made Speaker Boehner, but we are making the core offer we made Speaker Boehner indivisible. In other words, Republicans can't say we want the Medicare and Social Security cuts, but we don't want the loophole closers and the related revenue increases.
Robert Greenstein, founder and executive director of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Kevin Hassett, how do you interpret what you've seen? How do you react to it?
I think the first headline, which is a really refreshing one, is that we have actually moved, as Speaker Boehner intended, the whole budget debate out into the open. And so instead of having people meeting at the White House and coming out looking grumpy and we're all wondering, well, what's going on, we're in a position now where the normal order, really the founder's design, is actually working. People are saying what they want to do. They're putting their cards on the table in public. And then we're going to have a public debate about, well, should we do this? Should we do that? I think that's really refreshing. I think that it actually is a sign that there might be hope for a big deal this year, because we're kind of now at the point where the Senate has a budget, the House has a budget, the President has a budget, and they're all a little bit different, but they are in play and they're out in view. And so I think that the headline for me is that the President's playing the game. And as Bob said, I think he played it responsibly. Again, we'll go into the details that I don't like, but he put down his final offer in the sort of closed-door negotiations. He said, here's what I was willing to give in December, and I'm still willing to give those things. And I think that the thing that's unique about that is that probably if we go back and think about these presidential budgets, usually they don't matter. Usually, whichever party has the White House, that party is reluctant to put the president's budget to a vote. They don't even want it to go to the floor. We've seen President Obama's budget has been put to the floor and not gotten any Democratic votes in the past, right? So that usually the budget is the thing that shows what the president would do in an ideal world, not what people like would necessarily want to pass as a budget. I think this one's different. Kevin, like you could actually see this one going to the floor.
Kevin Hassett, Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Is this one serious, Dean Baker? And does it have a chance of really beginning the debate?
Well, in terms of the politics, I think I'd probably agree largely with Kevin that it's obviously a serious offer putting on the table. Now, the question is it good? Is this where I think people want to see it go? And I just raised two points in that. One, again, the issue about Social Security that I think certainly will be front and center. I think you're a little hard-pressed to see seniors as somehow the big winners in this economy. The median income for people over 65 is $20,000 a year. So any cut to their income, however modest, and we'll have to see what this ends up looking like, but the chain CPI basically is a cut of about 3.5% of Social Security income. I should point out it's a bigger hit to the typical senior than the tax increases were to the typical wealthy person affected.
So are you saying that would be on those currently receiving Social Security?
As it stands, the chain CPI, this means you would reduce the benefit, the cost of living adjustment you'd get next year, the year after, the year after. So it would affect people who are currently getting benefits. So that would hit in immediately. So I think that's a big deal. The other part, and again, I think this, to my mind, is the biggest part of the story. The president really lost control of the debate. The budget, first and center, foremost, is an economic document. And, we have large deficits because the economy collapsed. That's not ambiguous. We had relatively small deficits. We could say they were bigger than we wanted, if you like. But, 05, 06, 07, deficits were just over 1% of the GDP. We got large deficits because the economy collapsed. So instead of focusing on getting the economy going again, we now have people running around Washington like chickens with their heads cut off. We have to get the deficit down. And the reality is, if you actually look at the interest burden, which is probably the better measure, the interest burden's at a post-war low. It's about 1% of GDP. And if you subtract off what the Fed refunds to the Treasury in interest each year, it's half of 1% GDP. It's the lowest it's been since before the Great Depression. So we shouldn't be worried about the deficit. But I know President Obama feels boxed in. He's got to say that. And unfortunately, that means we're condemned to a period of slow growth and high unemployment.
Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And back to you, Nancy Cook. How does the president's proposal, how is it similar to or different from the House budget, what the House proposed?
Well, it's very different in a number of broad ways. The president really wants to continue to go after getting more revenue. He thinks that's a very key part of this equation and really is only willing to make cuts to Medicare and Social Security if there's more revenue on the table. And he thinks that a great way to do that is by capping tax deductions for the wealthy and then also instituting this minimum tax called the Buffett rule. The House Republican budget takes a really different tact and would slash tax rates. It would call for tax reform, of course, and get rid of some unspecified tax breaks. But it would really bring down both the corporate tax rate and the individual tax rate and the individual side to two brackets. So that's a huge point. Some other highlights of the Republican budget is it really cuts non-defense domestic discretionary spending, which is the spending on things like education, transportation, housing assistance. So that becomes a much smaller share of the budget in the long run. And that's not really where most of the money goes towards. So there's a bunch of key differences.
Nancy Cook, a reporter for National Journal. Short break here. We have many callers on the line. We'll try to get to as many as we can. Stay with us. And welcome back. As we talk about the president's proposed fiscal 2014 budget, which is being sent to the Congress today, here in the studio, Robert Greenstein, Dean Baker, Kevin Hassett, and Nancy Cook. Dean Baker, the president said he wanted to specifically seek to protect some groups. How do you read that?
Well, it's a mixed bag. I mean, Bob's more up to date on the latest proposal, and I know there's some provisions to protect some of the programs. For example, supplemental security income, my understanding is that it would continue to be raised, the cost of living adjustment would be raised in accordance with the old CPI. So that means beneficiaries in that program would not be affected. So there's a few other programs, and again, Bob, I'm sure, can give more detail. But I still see anything like this being very limited for two reasons. One is you have a large population of seniors that maybe they wouldn't be poor. Let's say people get by in $11,000, $12,000 a year, but they would still be hit by this. The other part, and I don't see a way around this, the poverty line itself is going to follow the consumer price index. And that's going to rise more rapidly, which means that people would otherwise qualify for various programs, Medicaid, TANF. We have a lot of programs that are tied to the poverty line. those people, when we get out 5, 10 years, you have a lot of people that will not qualify for those programs.
Bob Greenstein, you're shaking your head.
Well, it's reasonable that Dean would have assumed that was the case, but it's not the fact, because when the plan rolls out in a couple of hours, we will see that programs targeted on low-income people, including those related to the poverty line measure, will be exempt from the new chain CPI. So it will not have the effect on low-income people that Dean just mentioned. What's most interesting is Social Security. So I'm going to make two statements that people will find puzzling, given everything they've heard about the chain CPI. The president's proposal on balance will result in a slight reduction in poverty among very old seniors, and a number of current beneficiaries will end up being better off, not worse off. How can that be? Because the president's proposal has an adjustment starting at age 76, phased in over 10 years, where benefits will be adjusted by 5% of the average Social Security benefit. So bear with me for a moment. The chain CPI will rise about a quarter of a percentage point more slowly than the regular CPI. Let's say you start getting at 65, you've been getting benefits for 20 years at 85, 20 years, a quarter of a point less per year, that's a 5% benefit reduction, but you'll have a 5% benefit increase. So at age 85, the two will offset each other and you'll be about even. Now, the adjustment is 5% of the average Social Security benefit. But low-income seniors have a below-average Social Security benefit, so the adjustment is more than 5% for them, and this is why you actually get a very small, I don't want to overstate it, a very small effect on average for low-income seniors in very old age.
Captain Hassett, how do you read that?
Yeah, I can see the logic and the design. They're trying to cut Social Security benefits, and they're trying to cut them in a progressive way so that the folks who have money in the bank get a bigger cut than the folks who maybe have less money in the bank. And so if I were going to cut Social Security, I would look for bigger cuts over the long run than what we've got in the president's proposal. But a formula like that is a clever way to make sure that the folks that, you know, at the bottom, the folks closer to poverty, are not pushed down into poverty because of the cuts.
What are your biggest – what do you see as the biggest drawbacks?
Well,
to
again,
the president's plan.
I think that as an offer, it's a solid offer. I think that Republicans are extremely wary of having yet another tax increase. If you look at tax revenue over the next decade, it's going to be high by historical standards. By the end of the decade, it'll be about as high as we've ever seen. And so if you're already looking at very, very high revenues relative to GDP, then having a tax increase on top of that seems like a place that Republicans will fight very, very hard this year.
Who is going to be hit with those higher taxes?
The president's proposal would hit high-income people the
starting
most.
Starting at?
That, yeah, I haven't seen the proposal out yet, but do you know
Nancy
exactly?
Cook.
Nancy, 250?
Yeah, it would start at $250,000 for a family, and that's where you would start to cap itemized deductions for people.
And does that make sense, Dean Baker?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of capping the deductions at a lower rate, 28%, is much, much better than what many of the Republicans have put on the table, for the simple reason that we have, and I'm sure Kevin will jump on this right away, but you have states, say New York State, California, that have fairly high state income taxes, 11% at the high end. And as it stands now, basically the government picks up 40% of that. If you were to absolutely cap that, then basically there'd be a lot of pressure. State and local governments, the tax would be a full 11%. There'd be a lot of pressure for them to lower their taxes. So I think the 28% route is a much better way to go. Let me just quickly say something on the CPI. I'm glad to hear what Bob was saying, and I certainly hope that, insofar as you ameliorate it, that's a very good thing, the cut to Social Security. But I should still point out, you have a lot of people, they won't even live long enough to get these bump ups. So, those people will not be affected by that. Again, it's good they're in there. I'm glad for that. But again, you're still talking about a big hit to a lot of people.
All right. We've got lots of callers with questions. So let's put headphones on and see if we can answer their questions. First to Aberdeen, North Carolina. Good morning, Marion. You're on the air.
Well, good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Well, I recently read a lengthy profile of Eric Cantor in The New Yorker titled House of Pain, in which it was stated and, you know, revealed. I didn't realize this, that actually when after John Boehner had secretly negotiated with the president on the, quote, grand bargain, he decided to bring Eric Cantor into, you know, the discussion. And Cantor refused to back the grand bargain. So that's when Speaker Boehner dropped that negotiation. Okay, so now we have another attempt. What is the position now of Eric Cantor and the Tea Party? How do they fit into this? He's been very quiet recently.
Kevin has.
Sure. I think that dynamic there is not something I wasn't talking to the folks while they were participating in this negotiation. There are a couple of different stories about what happened. There are people who are mad that the president changed his offer after sort of asserting that it's final. Bob Woodward has covered that. But I do know that Mr. Boehner has a tough job. He's got to work out a deal that passes a budget that is, you know, I think has to give cover to people who just voted on tax increases and have pretty much told them no tax revenue is going to be on the table as we do the spending part. The way I can see it working out is that if the House and the Senate pass spending reductions, maybe, you know, repair the sequester and so on and work on some of the ideas of spending reduction that the president has, and then they agree to have a tax reform later in the year that has a certain amount of revenue as a sort of entry price for tax reform, then I could see a deal happening. But I think that the budget as proposed by the president is something you could never get through the House, because right now they want spending cuts before they're willing to talk about revenue.
Bob Greenstein.
We've been talking about the fact that the president's budget is actually a compromise budget. It was his final offer to Speaker Boehner. Not only did Speaker Boehner walk out of the negotiations in December, but his position is no longer his final offer back to the president. His position, Mitch McConnell's position, the Senate minority leader, is no revenues at all. Boehner's final offer in December had $400 billion more in revenue than Congress passed at the beginning of January. Boehner had tentatively agreed to the 28% limitation, this cap on itemized deductions that we've just talked about. So I do think there's something troubling here. People are saying, well, you know, the president was good to his final offer. He left it on the table. I think the question now is, what about the Republicans? They now need to show some movement as well. The president, as we're seeing in the paper, has really taken on many people in his own party and his base. They're very angry at him.
Deepmaker, would you agree with that?
And I was just going to say, and the Republicans have retreated and are completely embedded back in their base and saying no revenue at all.
Yeah, well, I certainly would say President Obama has made very large concessions, the Social Security cuts being, you know, first and foremost. But the other part, and I don't think we should ignore this, a very big deal. His basically proposal on domestic discretionary spending, this is the area of the budget that involves most infrastructure, research and development, most of what we think of the federal government doing, that proposes having that cut by 35% as a share of GDP over the next decade. So that's a very, very big hit to a large section of the federal government. Now, how that pans out, if you envision going out over the next decade, of course, we don't know. But to act as though that's not a big concession, that, of course, is, and one I'm not very happy about.
Kevin Hassett?
Yeah, and the response to what Bob and Dean were just saying would be this, just that the deal at the turn of year was basically a tax deal. And so we were negotiating about spending reductions and tax increases and increases that the Republicans didn't want to have happen and so on. And then we ended up with a tax deal that was focused on taxes. And what they want to do now is have a spending deal and then a tax reform. And they want to do it in two steps. But I think that if you go back and look, that basically none of the spending asks really happened at the turn of the year, that they in the end focused on the taxes. It suggests that their position is a fully reasonable one. It's let's go through those spending things that we couldn't agree on last time. Let's settle those, and then let's have a tax reform.
All right. Nancy Cook, I want to ask you, what about the projections under the president's budget as to deficit reduction? What would we see under his plan?
Sure. So the White House has estimated that, and again, I haven't seen the full budget, but the White House has told reporters that the deficit for the next fiscal year would come down to about $744 billion. And, you know, the deficit is supposed to keep going down over the next few years. The problem is, at the end of the next decade, the deficit is going to start rising just because of the cost of these health care, you know, the health care programs like Medicare and Medicaid that are expanding, more people are taking advantage of them. So the president's budget certainly brings down the deficit in the short run.
Are we going to come down to a flat-out political battle that has nothing to do with the American people at all, but has everything to do with Republicans versus Democrats?
I think that we may, because I think that although increasingly Americans tell pollsters that they're really interested in the idea of deficit reduction, and Pew Research Center has done some great polling that shows that, really, they really diverge on the details of how they want to see that done. And so what you have happening is Americans increasingly outside of Washington really concerned about jobs and the economy, and they want that to keep going. They want to see the economy get better. They want the unemployment rate to go down. But meanwhile, the conversation in Washington for the last 2 years has really been dominated by this idea of the deficit and fiscal responsibility, and we're continuing on that path. I think one of the fascinating political dynamics, and we've hinted at this a little bit in these conversations, is that the president basically is alienating some of his Democratic base by proposing these Social Security cuts and, you know, causing a rift in the party. But also there's a rift in the Republican Party, too, on economic issues. And they can't quite decide should they keep up with this agenda of austerity or emphasize some other things.
Nancy Cook, a reporter for National Journal. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Dean Baker, you want to add to that?
Yeah, just a quick point in terms of, you know, the politics, at least around the country. I mean, there have been a number of polls that show that when you look at, you know, the core, you know, programs, Social Security and Medicare, those enjoy huge amounts of bipartisan support. So the differences in support for Social Security and Medicare between Democrats, Republicans, even self-identified Tea Party supporters actually is very small. None of those groups want to see cuts. So this is a case where you kind of have Washington against the rest of the country.
What is your primary objection to the president's budget plan?
Well, as I say, I think the priority at this point really should be on jobs and growth, and getting the deficit down goes in the opposite direction. We might love the private sector. We might want to see a lot more investment. I'd love to see it, but realistically, that's not going to happen. If you look at the investment share of GDP, equipment and software have never been much over 8% of GDP. We're close to that today. The idea is somehow we're going to see some big surge there, or that there'll be a big surge in consumption when the savings rate is already lower than its historical average. It's not going to happen. So if we want to see growth, it really has to be led by the government at this point, and we're just being derelict on that.
All right, let's take a call from St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Terry. You're on the air.
Good morning. I actually have two questions after listening along a little while. Number one, I'm wondering whether Mr. Cook doesn't understand.
Nancy
I'm
Cook.
I'm sorry, no.
Maybe you mean Dean Baker.
I do, and I apologize for that. Whether he doesn't understand that this change in the cost of living is not actually a cut, which I think seniors hear cut and they think you mean you're going to reduce my current benefit. It is a reduction in the increase going forward. Benefits will continue to increase, but at a lesser rate. The other question that I had was, why does it seem that so many people on the left of this discussion are opposed to the fact that many seniors sacrificed and saved over their working lives so that they wouldn't be totally dependent on Social Security?
Dean Baker.
Those are good questions. First off, I'm trying to avoid semantics. We have scheduled benefit increases. This reduces scheduled benefits increases to keep benefits in line with the cost of living. Now, we're debating over what the cost of living is, and, you know, again, I don't think there's evidence that the current adjustment overstates it for seniors. For other people, it may well. The evidence suggests it may actually understate it for seniors. A technical issue I'd happy to go into. I don't think Diane wants me to right now. So I'm trying not to get into semantics. We're reducing the benefits what's currently there in law. Now, as far as seniors who've saved, I mean, I think that's wonderful, but we have the data on this. Most seniors actually do not have very much. The Social Security benefit is more than half of the income for about 70% of seniors. And, you know, you could say they should have saved more. The reality was the economy, I think, was a lot worse than most seniors expected. Maybe they should have known we'd had a bad economy, but that's how it ended up.
Dean, I think that what Terry is arguing, if I can take this on, is that when you talk about cuts, you are frightening seniors into believing that what they're receiving now is going to be cut. And what the president is saying is that the rate of growth will be reduced by a fraction in order to begin to balance and to make sure that everybody gets what they need.
Well, again, I don't want to get into semantics here, but the logic of the way the program is currently structured, benefits are supposed to rise to keep the real level of benefits constant. So we know we have inflation year by year, you know, say roughly.
But everybody is going to have to give in this debate. And I think that that's what Terry is arguing. And those on the left, those on the right, everybody is going to have to give.
Well, that's actually, I think, a questionable proposition. That's...
Okay, and we'll take a short break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Carol Burnett is best known as the star of her long-running TV variety show. In a new book, she describes a darker chapter in her life, the death of her daughter. Carol Burnett on her life and career, The Diane Rehm Show. Next hour. Back talking about the ins and outs of a very complicated presidential budget that is being released today. Here's an email from Aaron in Indianapolis. Does President Obama's proposed budget address the sequester currently in effect? Bob Greenstein.
It repeals sequestration. This is something we should point out, that right now sequestration is in law. It's starting to cause problems. We're seeing people lose certain kinds of cancer treatments. The problems are going to deepen. The cuts will get deeper in the new fiscal year starting in October if sequestration stays in effect. And the president's budget, part of how it should be understood, is replacing sequestration with, in my view, a much more balanced set of changes. The other key point Dean mentioned jobs, is how this affects the economy. The Congressional Budget Office has said that if sequestration stays in effect, we'll have 750,000 fewer jobs by this fall than we otherwise would. The president repeals sequestration. He has more than makes up for it in savings, but his savings are phased in. The deeper discretionary cuts, which neither Dean nor I like very much, but they don't start till 2017, and he has about $175 billion in infrastructure investment, $50 billion of it right up front. So the immediate effect on the economy relative to keeping sequestration in place would be hundreds of thousands more jobs.
Kevin Hassett, what does the president propose as to defense spending?
The defense spending part I haven't seen yet because it hasn't come out. Nancy, have you seen?
Well, we just know sort of the top line stuff, but part of replacing the sequester would be still having some cuts to defense, but it would be a lot less than what we're having now. It would be, I think, about $100 billion rather than sort of these indiscriminate cuts now. And so the way that the president replaces the sequester is partly through, you know, raising a bunch of new taxes and then partly in making smaller, more nuanced cuts to all these different programs.
All right. And here is a Facebook comment from Aaron, who says, mark my words, next year, Republicans will be campaigning on the Obama cuts to Social Security. They've cleverly gotten Obama to commit to cuts without themselves committing to cuts, so they can use it as an issue. They don't really care about reducing Social Security. They only care about keeping taxes on the wealthy low. Is that your prediction, Kevin?
I think that there's some historical truth to that on both sides, that whenever anybody – that's why they call it the third rail, right? That when somebody tries to put the programs into a balanced situation by, you know, phasing in cuts or slower growth over time, the other party attacks them. In fact, we, you know, even President Obama was attacked on the cuts to Medicare in the last election in a way that I disagreed with.
Isn't
I thought he was
precisely what Republicans have called for right along.
It's going. Yeah, I mean, the point is that's why this is so tricky. The there's a temptation for both sides to start to be partisan as opposed to responsible.
Dean Baker, what do you expect?
Well, I would expect them to do that. Yeah. You know, again, Social Security is hugely popular across the political spectrum, and these cuts are going to be, you know, they're very unpopular among Democrats, but they're very unpopular among Republicans and independents. They're unpopular across the board. People do not want to see that program cut.
All right. Let's go to Nicholas in Houston, Texas. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane Reed. Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure.
I just wanted to say during the market crash and the Great Depression, Herbert Hoover went to the private industry. They tried cutting and cutting, and it just got worse and worse. Wasn't it until FDR came in and started spending? Every businessman I've ever heard is you have to spend money to make money. Shouldn't we be spending and investing and getting more people back to work instead of worrying about doing little cuts, because then we'll bring in more revenue?
Well, we are running big deficits right now, which is a sort of textbook metric of whether the government on net is stimulating. They're spending a lot more than they're taxing. The government has its foot on the accelerator. The fact is, though, that this debate, and this is where Nicholas is really hitting the nail on the head, this debate would be much different if the economy were growing at 3.5% or 4% right now than in the economy that we have, where we just had a really disappointing jobs report and we're wondering whether we're going to slow down to 1.5% again. And so I think that it's exactly right that we're still in this place where people are trying to thread the needle, where growth is unacceptable, unemployment is unacceptably high. We're worried about the long-run impact of deficits, but worried also that we need to stimulate in the short term. And so it's a very difficult thing to balance.
Dean Baker, how did the two parties differ on their outlook on the deficit?
I'm not sure there's a huge difference. I think that's a really big problem. I mean, at the moment, you know, I disagree with Kevin in the sense that the deficit's about 4.5% of GDP. That's not, to my view, nearly large enough. Over the longer term, you know, when we talk about the long-term deficit picture, as Sharon was saying earlier, it's a healthcare story, and we've actually gotten very good news in healthcare recently. Healthcare costs have been growing very, very slowly. If that continues, I don't know that it will, but if that continues, we don't have a long-term deficit problem either. So here we are running around like chickens with our heads cut off, not doing what we need to do to get the economy growing again over a problem that may not even exist, even in the long term.
All right. To Ethan in Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on the
line.
Sure.
Go right ahead, please.
Okay. I, as I've been listening, I might have sort of answered my question, but I think it's an important issue for us to think about. So earlier in the show, it was mentioned that the general public generally agrees that cuts need to be made in spending and the deficit needs to be reduced. However, I don't know if it's a reflection of Washington or if Washington is a reflection of this dynamic. There is wide disagreement on how those things need to be done. Now, it's understandable because the general public are not professionals in terms of how they're educated about public policy issues and the implementation of social programs and how the federal government spends their money. Understandable. However,
Ethan, give me your question, if you would, please.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to waste time.
That's all right. I just need your question.
Right. And so my question is, how do you, Diane, and I guess the rest of your panel, propose that we might be able to, as a general public, become more educated about what the real issues are? Like, programs like this are a great example, but not everyone listens to programs like this.
They should.
They should. I absolutely agree.
All right. Bob Greenstein, how do you propose people educate themselves not only about what the president is proposing, but also about how Republicans are receiving that proposal?
I don't have a magic answer here. I do think listening to the show is part of it. I mean, part of the problem in the news media these days is we don't have enough in-depth exploration. People like Nancy write longer, more detailed articles. If you just watch cable TV, it isn't clear whether you kind of know more or maybe you get misled and know a little bit less sometimes. Also, a number of organizations, ours, Dean's, Kevin's, we don't agree with each other on all of these issues, but we all post Brookings, we all post more extensive analyses of these issues on our websites.
That's why we bring you all together. good luck, Ethan. Let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio. Sally, you're on the air.
Thanks, Diane. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
I'm glad. Thank you.
Nancy made a comment in the beginning of the show about Mitt Romney's IRA, and it sounded like she was saying it shouldn't be that large. And I think that's very misleading to people. It comes across as judgmental. His IRA is his IRA. My IRA is my IRA. I happen to know that the rules are pretty much the same for people. He had a larger corporate salary. He had a larger corporate benefit. He rolled it into his IRA. His IRA is large. You know, so I'm just cautioning her on using rhetoric like that.
All right, Nancy.
Yeah, thanks for that comment. I didn't mean to imply that Mitt Romney shouldn't have a large IRA. The point that I was trying to make is really that the president very successfully during the 2012 campaign ran against Mitt Romney by painting him as this out-of-touch rich person. It was very successful in putting the Republicans on the offensive about that. And he's continuing to do that with this budget by still calling into account trying to limit the IRA, by taxing rich people. And it's sort of this continuing theme of we need to tax rich people to reduce the deficit. So I think it's a continuing...
How would IRAs be limited?
I don't know the specifics of the proposal, but just getting to the point, the IRA was designed as a middle-class retirement program. When you have, I believe it was $100 million, clearly that's not middle class. Now, again, maybe Mitt Romney did nothing at all improper, but that's a problem with the way the law is structured, if that's possible.
Dean Baker. Bob Greenstein.
I mean, look, the IRAs essentially provide, it's a tax break, it's a tax shelter for part of your retirement savings. We've said we're going to create this tax shelter to help, as Dean said, middle-income people have enough savings for retirement. Romney used accountants and tax lawyers. I've talked to tax lawyers who told me that Romney went so far, they wouldn't advise it for their clients. It was not explicitly illegal. It's in that gray area. But you've got to ask the question, how do we ask people on Social Security to take somewhat less of a cost of living adjustment? How do we make cuts in areas like education and say we're going to keep tax shelters for $50 million, $100 million IRAs when they're absolutely unnecessary for someone like Romney to have enough to live on in retirement?
Good question, Kevin has.
Yeah, and I've got a good answer. You know, the bottom line is that if society's going to grow, if we're going to have more consumption in the future, then the way we have to do that is we have to acquire more assets. It could be physical assets like machines. It could be human capital because we invest in education and so on. But over time, consumption growth is only going to come if we have more assets to draw from, to produce with. And one of the ways that we own future assets or acquire future assets is we put money in the bank. And so, you know, optimal tax theory in every textbook teaches that we need to encourage people, the Mitt Romneys, to put money in the bank because then the bank could lend that to people to buy machines and
but
so on. And so we need to do that. It's optimal tax policy to encourage people to invest in the future.
If only 1% of the population can do that to the tune of $100 million. That raises questions.
No, but we want capital so that workers have machines to work with so they can have higher wages.
What are these people using their capital for, Dean Baker?
Yeah, I think it's, well, one, we don't have a shortage of capital right now. The problem is we actually have more and no one wants to use it. So that's hardly the issue, you know, in the current economy. But the point more generally is this was a tax scam. So, you know, by all means, we want, you know, wealthy people to invest their money. But this was a tax scam. So one could argue, and I know Kevin would argue this, he wants lower tax rates on the wealthy in general, but to have a tax scam where you could shelter your money completely from taxation for however many years until he withdraws that. That's not the purpose of IRAs.
And to Mike in Pensacola, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for the show and my access to it. I'd like to ask comments on two sides of the same issue. One, the premise that increased tax rates will raise more revenue than leaving rates the same. And on the other hand, that decreasing tax rates will lower revenue. And all of this seems to be preying, that the rhetoric seems to prey on the ignorant, those people that, you know, can't do their own income tax, that have no clue that they don't pay income tax, those people who...
I have the feeling that a great many people who pay no income tax are not ignorant, but rather pretty darn smart. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Bob Greenstein.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the caller was trying to say, but if he was trying to say that raising rates doesn't increase revenue and lowering rates doesn't lose revenue, virtually no reputable analysts believe that. In fact, in 2007, I think it was, the George W. Bush Treasury Department studied this, and I think in their most optimistic scenario, where you lowered rates and fully paid for it by cutting spending, you know, maybe a tenth of it came back in higher revenues from higher growth, and something like 90% of it was just a revenue loss.
I think one key thing to remember is that no one's fighting over tax rates right now. What we're fighting over is limiting tax breaks for wealthy people. And one interesting area where all the parties agree, actually the Senate Democrats' budget talked about this, the House Republican budget, the President's budget, is this idea of somehow limiting or getting rid of tax breaks. And they disagree on how to go about doing that, which ones are bad ones. But there does seem to be this emphasis in all the budgets on weeding through this huge number of tax breaks that cost the federal government over $1 trillion a year.
What do Republicans risk by doing nothing? There has been some talk about the GOP that maybe they simply do absolutely nothing and let the president's budget die.
Well, I think that that's certainly an outcome that's almost as likely as any other, that we just sort of muddle through. And the Republicans decide that the sequester cuts are all they're going to get, and they're not going to get much more, and then they just keep sort of continuing resolution our way to the next election.
Is that a political judgment, or is that a sound financial
I think that getting ahead of the curve on spending, as they did in the previous agreement, was a good idea. I think that there are better ways to do it, and it would be great if people could be adults and come to an agreement about how to do it. So, for example, on the tax revenue side, I absolutely agree that the president's proposal to reduce itemized deductions to put broaden the base is a good one. It's that if I were going to start a tax reform, then the limitation on itemized deductions would be the first place I would look to get the revenue I need to have a tax reform. But to make it clear where the debate is now, that's not really what the proposal
is exactly.
It's that the president wants to spend a lot more money on these things, and he's going to raise revenue with what I think is the entry ticket to tax reform, and that, I think, would short-circuit the kind of fixes that we really need.
Bob Greenstein.
Actually, I think what the president is proposing is what conservative Harvard economist Martin Feldstein, who was Ronald Reagan's chief economics advisor, has written. Feldstein has said, Republicans want to reduce the deficit by cutting spending. Democrats want a mix. Here's the way you do both. You get some savings from reducing program spending, and you get the rest of the savings by reducing spending in the tax code, mm-hmm. subsidies in the tax code, the tax expenditures Nancy talked about, and that's exactly what the president's budget would do.
Robert Greenstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Kevin Hassett of the American Enterprise Institute, Nancy Cook, a reporter for National Journal. Thank you all so much for clarifying some portions of these muddy, muddy waters. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rain.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Novo.